It's the one time in the week when we all get together and think about something in common. We try to give a good stimulating program, and certainly if people have suggestions about colloquial, there are a lot of free spots next time, so please contact us about it. Let me just preview the next few coming up. Next week we have Andy Albrecht, who is a very well-known cosmologist from UC Davis. And he's going to be talking about the clock ambiguity and some more adventurous things. Some of the things he does are very straightforward, data-driven and so on, but this is just for us, API, and some his more adventurous work on the issue of time in cosmology and what is the law of nature. Then on October 29th, we have Sarah Diamond, who is an artist, a very influential artist who has worked a lot with scientists and with technology. And she is also president of the Ontario College of Art and Design, so she's very much a VIP and is coming here to stimulate and to try to develop contacts between science and the arts. So for that in particular, if there's anybody who wants to meet with her, we have to do that in advance because she's a VIP, so please let me know. No, because when you're scheduling the president of the university, you schedule by the 10 minute. You know, they come here, they do what they're going to do, and they're on the limo and they're gone. So then on November 5th, we have Vincent Redesou, who is from Paris. He is a mathematical quantum field theorist, and he's going to be talking about recent developments in the theory of renormalization. On November 12th, Kaijang Wen, who is an increasingly influential condensed matter physicist from MIT, who has been doing a lot of work which overlaps to the notions of emergence of gauge theories, topological gauge theories, gravity even. On November 19th, we'll have one of our sessions in the bistro. On the 26th, Catherine Callan, who's also a condensed matter physicist, and just to tell you the rest of the schedule, December 3rd, Abhay Ashtekar, who is a very well-known person in quantum gravity, and December 10th, Keith Dines. And there are also some very exciting people on the program for next term, even in the Academy Award winner.
Special effects,
yes. Yes, Pixar. Rob Cook, who is Vice President for Technology at Pixar, will be coming. Okay, it's a great pleasure to have today Chris Elias Smith, who is a local colleague from the University of Waterloo. Chris is a theoretical neuroscientist who is Canada Research Chair in that subject and directs a research center in that subject. But more formally, he is also a professor of philosophy, and he's also a professor of engineering. And I think I'll just leave it to him to explain how those things fit together.
Thank you very much, Lee, and thanks for the invitation. I won't explain how those things fit together. It should be obvious by the end of my talk, without any explanation necessary. So the talk I'm going to give you today is something of an introduction to the area of neuroscience, because presumably it's not especially familiar to many of you. But I want to start by pointing out a deep analogy. And this is, in fact, an analogy I didn't just dream up for today. It's one that I almost always use when I try to explain to people what I do, that is what theoretical neuroscience is. And it's an analogy between theoretical physics and theoretical neuroscience, because they're often more familiar with theoretical physics, or at least I think they are. Right? So the analogy is basically a methodological one. Right? I think there are deep methodological similarities between these two fields. The first is that both want to quantify phenomena. Right? So for instance, in theoretical physics, we can take a sort of leading edge theory like this one. And we notice that what we're doing here is trying to explain relationships, right, using equations, using math. So we're trying to be very precise about the relationships that we're explaining. And of course, as being facetious, it's not that leading edge. But I've chosen it for a good reason, and this is to make you keep in mind that theoretical neuroscience is a very young discipline, right? And essentially, I think we are, if this far along, right, at the very beginnings of the field. And so we can look to theoretical neuroscience for similar quantified relationships. So here's an example. This might mean more to you by the end of the talk. But essentially, it's trying to say something like the information that's represented in a neural system, that's x hat, is equal to some weighting, which we'll have to determine, over the activities of the cells inside the brain. Right? So it's some kind of quantified relationship which we want to use to describe our theory about how the brain works or how it represents information. Similarly, both have as a main goal the summarizing of lots and lots of data. Right? So in my talk title, I had the word unification. And I know that has many different meanings, but essentially, this is what I mean. Right? We want to take phenomena, in the case of theoretical neuroscience, across the brain and try to come up with quantified ways of describing a large amount of that phenomena. So for instance, in theoretical physics, this equation is supposed to apply to the motion of objects, regardless of whether it's linear motion or rotational motion. Similarly, we'd like an equation like that to apply to the neural representation of information, whether it's visual information, auditory information, or what have you. A third thing that they share is that both are speculative. So we use these kinds of quantifications in order to generate a hypothesis. And they usually include some kinds of assumptions when we write out those particular relationships. So of course, in this case, Newton originally thought this was true for all velocities. And we would like to suppose that maybe this equation is true for all stimuli. Okay, so of course, this is hypothetical. We don't know for sure. But it's basically a working hypothesis that we can use to either fine-tune the theory or learn something new about the system of interest. Now, for having shared all these things, of course, there are obvious differences too. Theoretical physics is interested in what there is, what's the fundamental stuff of the universe, how is it organized. And theoretical neuroscience is interested in who we are, what are the sort of basic computational units or the basic functional units that, when organized appropriately, give rise to all the complex behaviors that we see, cognitive behaviors in humans and all kinds of other behaviors in animals. So with that quick sort of methodological introduction, what I'm going to do now is turn to some brain facts, throw them at you. And they're obviously ones that I hope are relevant for understanding what I'm going to be talking about later on. But it's essentially to give you an introduction to some of the mechanisms that are basic and fundamental for understanding how the brain works. So to start, the brain's not that big. It's only about 2% of body weight. There's one spinning around up in the corner there. It's about the size of your two fists if you put them together. Nevertheless, it uses an enormous amount of energy. About 25% of the energy produced by the body is consumed by the brain. And that means, presumably, it's doing something important, right? Or evolution wouldn't have preserved it with that kind of energy usage. However, whatever it's doing, it does extremely efficiently. It uses only about the equivalent of a compact fluorescent light bulb, right? So not very much energy, way more efficient than any of the computational things that we've built. If you take the cortex, which is sort of the crumpled part you can see spinning around, and you flatten it out, so that's actually a big sheet that's been crumpled in order to fit inside our skulls. If you flatten it out, it's about 2,000 centimeters square. It's about this big, four sheets of 8.5 by 11 paper. If you turn it on its side, there are approximately 6 layers of cells in there. If you count all the cells across all the layers over the entire area, you'll find that there are about 100 billion of them, which is a lot. That's a hard number to remember or to understand. So I always think of more in terms of 1 millimeter square. If you sort of took a core sample through that sheet, you'd end up with about 150,000 neurons in the 1 square millimeter. So we have lots and lots of parts to worry about, how they're connected together and how they're organized. So what I want to do now is, so this kind of gives you a really quick overview. But we're going to focus on probably what's the best understood part of the brain right now, and that's an individual neural cell. And neurons, so this is a picture of actual neurons that come from the hippocampus. Hippocampus is part of the brain that's used partly for navigation. So you probably used it in order to find your way to this room. And these three green cells are the ones of interest. We're ignoring the red cells. They are like every other cell in the body in that they have a cell membrane. They produce energy in the same way. They have a cell nucleus. What really differentiates these cells from others is the fact that they have so many processes. So all these things coming into and going out of the cell. So let's just focus for a minute on the cell in the top right corner. So this main, the large part is called the cell body. Coming into the cell body, all of these processes are called dendrites. And this is they're essentially inputs. They carry current from preceding cells to the cell body. That current, depending on the particular pattern of changes in the current, will, in the cell body, generate some sort of nonlinear response, which produces a very rapid change in voltage. And this is called an action potential. And these action potentials are extremely short. And so we often refer to them as spikes. And they'll be sent down the axon, which is essentially the output channel for the neuron. And they come in a pattern of some kind. So it's these sort of patterns that we think information is encoded into and used in order to be processed in the brain. Those patterns go down until they hit the dendrite of the next cell. And it's at a place called the synapse. And a synapse between an axon and a dendrite is a place where they actually come very close together, but they don't touch. So what happens is you have an action potential come to the end of the axon. That results in a set of processes which release chemicals into this space. Those chemicals are called neurotransmitters. They go across this synaptic cleft and hit the dendrite, which then produces some more changes which result in the inflow of ions, and you get a current that's produced in this dendrite. And the particular degree of effect that happens when a spike arrives depends on the particular synapse. So some synapses, when you get an action potential, will have a very big current that goes to the cell body, and others will have a much smaller current. And we think of that as a kind of weighting. So I'm going to be calling those connection weights or synaptic weights. So after this happens, as I said, you get a current of some kind that flows. This current is called a postsynaptic current. And I'll also refer to these subsequently. And they generally have a shape that looks something like this. And that postsynaptic current then basically begins the chain of operations again. Right? You get a bunch of postsynaptic currents from a whole bunch of cells, goes into the cell body, and you get another pattern of axons, of action potentials going down the axon. OK, so that's a supposedly canonical view of what happens in cells. There's one axon coming out, and then it branches into many branches after it comes out. So I've shown you one particular kind of neuron, but there are, in fact, hundreds or perhaps thousands of kinds of neurons. So it depends exactly how you count these, if you use physiology or anatomy or morphology or what have you. They range enormously in size, from the microscopic up to ones having axons about 5 meters in length. So you find that in the neck of a giraffe, for instance. The number of connections that they have can vary widely. So in the retina, for instance, there's about 500 inputs and outputs per cell. In the cerebellum, there are cells called Purkinje cells. So cerebellum is used to control balance and do other motor control processes. There are about 200,000 inputs and outputs per cell. So these are massively interconnected networks. So communication is very important. The connections are obviously playing a big role in the organization of the system. The communication is made even more complicated by the fact that, as I mentioned, you have an action potential come down and you get some chemicals released. The particular kind of chemical released, that is the particular kind of neurotransmitter, can vary within one cell. So I can generate an action potential. It can go down an axon, go to two separate cells, and release one kind of chemical here and another kind of chemical here. So that means it can have differential effects from the same originating signal. So taken together, all this stuff lets us know that when we're producing theories, they're going to have to account for this large amount of heterogeneity. Right? We're not going to be able to, or it's very artificial to pretend that there's one kind of neuron and that it has the same sorts of properties everywhere we go. So the heterogeneity is going to be a big challenge when we're trying to construct our theories. All right, so highly heterogeneous at the low level. The other thing that's also heterogeneous is how neuroscientists have looked at this system. So there's a really wide variety of methods that have been used to gain information about neural systems, ranging from entire brain scans down to collecting data at the level of individual cells, even smaller, looking at molecules and so on. So what I'm going to do now is just give you a quick overview of this kind of data. And I'll be sort of returning to trying to construct a theory that will be able to incorporate all this data later on, all these kinds of data. So this is perhaps the most common kind of data that you might have seen in a newspaper or magazine. This is from an fMRI machine, a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine. And what this shows is the part of the brain that has the most blood flow, which presumably means a lot of action potentials, when mothers view their own children, which is shown in red, or when they view somebody else's children, which is shown in blue. Now, this data is not irrelevant, right? So it's telling us something about the organization, you know, which part of the brain lights up when a particular function is being performed. But really, that information becomes more valuable if you do a whole bunch of these experiments and you see the same part being lit up under all different kinds of circumstances. But of course, it's very limited too. Knowing where something happens doesn't tell you what it's doing or how it's doing it. And of course, these blobs are probably covering millions and millions of neurons within one of those cells, or one of those blobs. So we're going to need data that is more precise than that if we actually want to start providing some sort of quantified theory. So here's sort of moving down a level in specificity. This is called surface imaging. And the example I'm going to be showing you here is taken from primary visual cortex. So this is at the back of the brain. And it's taken from monkeys. And what this movie shows is in the top right-hand corner is the stimulus that's being shown to the monkey in the center of a screen. And down here is the activity of the cells in primary visual cortex. So you can see that for different stimuli, for instance, when it moves down into the, or is that up into the right, you have neurons activated over here and down into the left over here. So up into the right is over there and down into the left is over here. But there is some degree of overlap as well. Okay, so this is now telling us something about the organization of the sensitivity of cells to different kinds of input. We can get a rough idea about how the neurons increase or decrease their activity. So when you see luminescence, that means that there's an increase in voltage, in particular calcium. And so this can start giving us a much finer grained information than, you know, some amount of blood flow change at a very high level. But we still would like to be able to, you know, look at the precise details of how a single neuron is reacting when you give it a particular kind of input. And so we'll have to use another kind of method. This is called electrophysiology. And essentially what is going on here is now you can isolate a single cell either in a petri dish or in a brain. You stick an electrode into it and you record what happens when you inject different kinds of current into it. So in the very top is the input to the cell. So this is now just injecting current right into the cell body. So it's supposed to be standing in for all the current that's flowing down the dendrites. And down here we see the cellular response from a cortical cell. And this is also a cell taken from visual cortex. So we can notice a few things right away. That is that the response of the cell is highly nonlinear, right? So you have these ridiculously high spikes. It's also nonlinear because you have a constant input and you have a slowing down of the spiking response of the cell. And you can also see that there are small changes in the heights of the spikes as they go along and so on, right? So there's a lot of complexity in this kind of response, even though the input that's driving the cell is fairly simple. So that's sort of a quick overview of the different kinds of methodologies and the different kinds of data that we're going to want to unify with a theory or try to bring under the umbrella of one theory. So the real question we have to ask when neuroscientists present us all this stuff is basically, what can we do with all this data, right? So you've now convinced me that you can generate lots of data, and I think it's really cool, right? Doing these experiments is hard, and the data is very interesting. But as many, both experimentalists and theoreticians have noticed that there's way more data than theory here. In fact, the data ridiculously outstrips the theory. So people have called neuroscience data rich and theory poor. Right? So we can generate gigabytes and terabytes of data from brain scans alone. Nevertheless, we don't really have methods for organizing the data, right, or predicting what's going to come out of a new experiment. So it's really missing this sort of systematic integration that we'd want from a scientific discipline. And so what I want to suggest is that we really need to try to start specifying unifying theories, that is, theories which are going to take all these different kinds of data, look across all the different sorts of heterogeneities you find in single cells, and bring them together in some sort of simple way in order to give us an understanding of neural systems. And I think really the argument can be made that that should be the job of theoretical neuroscience, especially if we take my analogy seriously. Now, one thing that's very different about theoretical neuroscience and theoretical physics is that the method for trying to affect this unification, I think, is fairly different in that in theoretical neuroscience, it relies largely on models. And by models, I mean numerically simulated models. This is because each of these individual cells are highly nonlinear systems, and you want to string a whole bunch of them together, millions of them, and you get this insane system that is now incredibly difficult to analyze. Right? So analytic methods only get you so far, usually. So models are crucial. So that's one reason that models are going to be important. And another, actually, I think is based on something that was voiced by Feynman. So here's a quote that is taken from his last blackboard. And it says, "What I cannot create, I do not understand." And of course, we can't go around building brains. But what we can do is try to build models, which are supposed to act just like those brains. And it's through constructing models which have functions, that is, they do information processing that looks something like what we see in the brain, being able to compare the output of our model directly to the experimental result across these different kinds of methods is going to give us a sense that we really do understand what's going on in the brain. So what is the current state of the field in theoretical neuroscience? But I think there's some good news, and the good news lays largely at the single cell level. There are very sophisticated models of single cells, which account for all the different nonlinearities that I pointed out to you before, and many others. They account for the spatial distribution of inputs in the dendritic tree and all kinds of other complexities. Another nice thing about these models is that they vary widely in computational complexity. So if you want to start stringing lots of these models together, if your model's too complicated, you essentially can't run it on a computer. But we have an understanding of these models such that simplifications are fairly well understood, and we can generate models that are very simple and yet preserve many of the important aspects of the original cellular models that we had. The news is not so good when we start talking about how these models or how these neurons are strung together into networks. And I'd argue that, in fact, most of the models that we find are ad hoc. So ad hoc means to this, and I think this is literally true in this case. That is, the network models are made to this particular part of the brain, and they're even often made to this particular set of experiments made on this particular part of the brain. So if you read a paper which has a model in it, you'll often have data from a neuroscientific experiment, and then you'll have a model which explains exactly that data and doesn't really go anywhere else. These models are often constructed by hand setting those connection weights. So the synaptic weights are essentially what determine the function of the network. These are often tuned by knowing in advance what kinds of tunings will result in approximately what kinds of functions. Again, there's no sort of principled ways of setting those connection weights. The other most common kind of method for building these models is through learning. Learning has lots of different problems. Obviously, it's important. So depending on the kind of question you ask, learning is important. The problems arise from the fact that we don't really know what biologically plausible learning rules look like. There are lots of implausible rules out there. Learning is difficult in trying to pick what data you show to the model in order to train it. If you pick it and you present it in a different order, you might get a completely different kind of function that's computed by the network. Often you need millions of epochs, so millions and millions of training cycles in order to get to the point that you want. For practical reasons, you're often limited to only three-layer networks. It might be because of a limitation of the network or just because it becomes computationally infeasible to train anything larger than that. So learning suffers from a large number of limitations in trying to construct models. And so I don't think we can really lean on it as being a theory that's going to bring together all of the data, at least not as we understand learning now. So here's an example of a large-scale model that you'd find in the field right now. So what I'm showing here is 50,000 neurons. These spikes generated by the neurons are shown in red and black. The impressive thing about the simulation is it's taken from a simulation of 100 billion neurons. So that's the same number of neurons approximately that you find in the brain. So, you know, the simulation computational power is there given this complexity of a cellular model, which is sort of midway between the simplest and the most complex that we have. Nevertheless, it takes a lot of time. So 1 second of real time, which you can see ticking way down here, took about 50 days on a supercomputer. But I don't think that's the biggest limitation. I think the biggest limitation is that the network is randomly connected, right? So there are basically, yeah.
The size of four sheets of paper.
Right.
What's the topology of it? If I were to unfold it, would be equivalent to a sphere or a torus or what?
That's a good question. I don't think people really know. I mean, it's so there's massive amounts of interconnectivity, long distance and local, in this network, and there's not a clear understanding of a simple topology that you're going to find in that sheet. Major fiber tracks have been drawn, and there's no obvious topology to that, I know. Right, so this model is randomly connected, right? And what that means essentially is that it's not performing any particular function of interest to us. It's computing something, right? But we don't really know how to go from specifying a function that we actually want it to compute to figuring out how to connect these cells together. So our work at the Computational Neuroscience Research Group, which is my lab, which is part of the Center for Theoretical Neuroscience, has really focused on this issue. And a few years ago, Charles Anderson and I wrote this book called Neural Engineering, and Charlie is a physicist. In it, we propose something that we call the Neural Engineering Framework, or NEF. And this is essentially an attempt to articulate a theory which is going to fill this gap, right? Try to put some connection between all the stuff that we know about single cells and our desire to implement certain kinds of high-level functions. So in a nutshell, if you give us an information processing task, so this means a specification of some function that you think is computed by some part of the brain, and you tell us a description of the hardware, right? So what do single cells do? What do they look like? What kind of response properties do they have? So that's the stuff that you get from neuroscience, experimental neuroscience. Then using our methods, we can produce a neural circuit, right? So this is going to be basically a bunch of connections and connection weights that you put between this hardware as so described, and it will implement that particular function that you specified. So some people have looked at this and said, well, you know, it's kind of neural compiler, right? So you have some high-level specification of a dynamical system, which is, you think, describing the high-level behavior of the system. And then using these methods in concert with what we know about the neurons in this brain, you translate from that high-level description into a description at the level of the hardware. This is sort of compiling in the sense of software compiling. Okay, so quickly returning to the analogy, that is the analogy between physics and neuroscience here, is that in the opening chapter of that book, we try to push the idea that this is actually something like a theory, and perhaps not unlike Newton's theory in the following respects. First is that there's three basic principles. The fact that there's three is irrelevant, right? The fact is that there are a few basic principles, okay? So this means that if it is effective, right, then what we've got is something that's general, right? So it's these three principles that are supposed to apply across cortical, subcortical, all different kinds of neural systems. And it's unified because, you know, we can basically reduce all the models or the way of constructing models back to a few principles. These principles are stated with mathematics, which means that they're quantitative. And finally, also like Newton's theory, is that we think it's probably wrong. Okay, and we say this in the book. We say this is a zeroth order guess. We're just trying to get off the ground here. But being wrong is not always a bad thing, right? So Newton was very successfully wrong. So wrong but useful, right? So depending on the explanations you want, people, of course, use Newton's theory all the time for giving an explanation that's relevant for many, many phenomena. So similarly, you know, this might be the case here. And so we've made an effort to show all the different kinds of circumstances under which this particular theory applies. And secondly, it's a start, right? So without a theory that's wrong at the beginning, of course, it's going to be difficult to build a more sophisticated theory. And so we're trying to, you know, pursue extensions to this particular theory, but you need somewhere to start, right? And so we're hoping that these three principles can perform that function. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is just try to run through those three principles and give you a flavor of what the theory is like. And the principles are the principle of representation, the principle of computation or transformation, and the principle of dynamics. And we think that those three things together should give us a complete description of the kinds of behaviors we find in neural systems. Okay, so before I just showed you how a single cell worked, and now I'm going to concentrate on all three cells. And so we're going to suppose that we've got three cells, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, right? I was told that those are the right terms to use in this context. Alice and Bob are going to be communicating to Charlie. Okay, so what we want to understand in representation is how is information, not worrying about information processing, just how can we get information from the first two cells down to the second cell? Okay, so we're going to suppose that they have some kind of input from the stimulus in the environment, right? So it could be a moving grating. They're going to generate action potentials in response to that stimulus. They're going to send those action potentials to synapses on Charlie. These are going to generate these postsynaptic currents, which go to Charlie, right? And then Charlie is going to be able to determine something about the original stimulus, right? Whatever information is in those postsynaptic currents, essentially, is going to be the information that Charlie has access to about the external world, the original stimulus. Okay, and then he's going to produce a response of some kind. Now, when neuroscientists characterize the relationship between a single cell response and the external world, they often draw what's called a neuron tuning curve. Okay, and a neuron tuning curve relates the stimulus in the world, which I'm calling X, to the activity of the cell, which here is just firing rate. Right, so it might be the case that Bob has this kind of relationship. This is a very common kind of tuning curve that you can find. What it means is, as the magnitude of X is increasing, so let's say velocity up and to the right is positive, down and to the left is negative. As the magnitude is increasing, the activity of that cell is going down. Okay, so now because we have this kind of relationship, where we know that if you actually inject current into the cell, the spike rate always increases as you have more current. But here it's flipped around, so we need to identify some other parameter, which we call a preferred direction vector, which of course is just a scalar in this case. We have another parameter which now relates the external stimulus in the world to the current that's driving this particular neuron. Okay, so this is essentially telling us how the activity of this cell relates to what's going on in the world through this parameter, which is relating the two. And of course, we can do the same thing for Alice, and she might have a different kind of preferred direction vector. So maybe for her, the activity increases as the stimulus magnitude increases. And so what we want to do is to take in together all these different ways of encoding that stimulus, right? How can Charlie try to extract information about the original stimulus? So what this really defines for us is an encoding. It takes the stimulus in the world and encodes it into spike responses. And that encoding is a function of both how the neuron relates to the world and of how that neuron is driven by current, which is injected in directly into the cell. OK, but to define a representation, we actually have to define two things, not only an encoding, but we also need to define a decoding. Right? How can we figure out what Charlie knows about the original stimulus by looking at only the postsynaptic currents that he gets? And I want to point out here that this decoding is purely theoretical, by which I mean we don't suppose that neurons are actually decoding the spikes that are arriving at them. What we're doing is we're characterizing decoding in order to understand what information is available to that neuron. OK, so let's look at a simple example. So we can presume this is velocity of the input stimulus. If we have two neurons, Alice and Bob, and they have different kinds of tuning curves, right? We're going to see different kinds of spike patterns given the same input signal. So perhaps Alice likes it when, so given the previous slide, Alice likes it when you have increasing magnitude, and Bob likes it when you have decreasing magnitude. So we get these two different kinds of spike responses. So that's the encoding I talked about before. Now what we want to do is define a decoding. And this is, in fact, related to work that's been done in the past. And the interest there was to figure out, well, what is the best possible decoding you could get, right? What information could possibly be in that spike train? However, when they do this, the decoders that they come up with are acausal, which means that the neuron, which would, if you pretended a neuron was trying to decode it, they would have to know where the spikes were coming before they got there, right? So it's not actually going to describe the mechanism in the system, but it will describe something about the information processing characteristics. So what we suppose instead is that we should use a filter. So we should use a decoder which maps onto the biophysiology. And so we suggest that we should use postsynaptic currents, because we know that when a spike arrives, right, we get neurotransmitters, and that results in a postsynaptic current. It's essentially like a temporal extending of this really narrow action potential. And for other reasons, which I can talk about later, it seems like linear decoding is the most appropriate one as far as biophysical realism and the amount of information that you get out. So if we take postsynaptic currents and we place them at every location that you have a spike, and we do that for both sets of cells, and then we simply sum the results, these are upside down because the preferred direction vector is negative, we can see that we get an estimate of the original input signal. Right? And so that tells us now, that's what we think the information that could be available to that cell is, if this is the appropriate way to understand the encoding and decoding. Of course, it's not a very good estimate. But as you increase the number of cells, you can make that estimate basically as good as you want. So the story for representation is that we have a highly nonlinear encoding. It's defined by our model of the single cell and our relationship to the external stimulus. And we can define a linear decoding using these postsynaptic currents. Of course, representation isn't that interesting. Right? We want to do stuff with the representation. We don't think brains get a bunch of light in and then represent the light. What they do instead is transform that information in order to pick out objects, right? Find conspecifics or what have you. So how can we understand this? Conveniently, it's very much like representation. If you think about representation, you can consider that a very simple transformation, basically mapping something onto itself, right? It's an identity function. So let's look at exactly the same input signal, right? So a bunch of velocities. And suppose we want to compute this function, which is just 2 times the original input, right? So Charlie's trying to compute this dotted line. Now, of course, Alice and Bob will have the same original, same response as they did to the original input. So our encoding doesn't change in any way at all. And up there, I've indicated basically how we're going to quantify this. So every time there is a spike transmitted by neuron A, we're going to say there's a delta function at that point. So at time tn, there's a delta function. The entire train of spikes would be a sum over all the delta functions at all those times tn. So in a dotted line, I've got the original postsynaptic current. Right? So that's the thing that if we're just trying to do a representation, what it would look like. But now, of course, we're trying to compute a function. So essentially, what we want to do is take that same sort of thing, but weight it in such a way that it's going to give us an estimate of this function. So the natural weighting is to double it, since what we're trying to do is compute 2 times x, and it's linear. Yep.
It's all doubled. You just shrank the axes.
So our reference is the original input signal.
I know that, but what you're saying is you have to compare it to something further down. I mean, like, you have to be able to, well,
so we have
to ask, don't you have to be able to compare, you know, what it would be transferred, what it be transforming into compared to what would just be transmitted?
So as far as axes go, right, if we take the units and we keep them consistent, then we're fine.
But what does that mean? I mean, are you just doing an...
Where do we get the units from?
Yeah.
So units we take from physics. So we assume, so this is a stimulus, right? It's the measure. It's measured by scientists, and it has some kind of units. And we can say, well, you know, do these neurons respond to this number of units or twice that number of units, or does it have twice the elevated activity?
That's Charlie, right? Sorry, it's Charlie that's getting the information, right? It's the third neuron?
Right.
Is that what you want to do? Okay, but then couldn't you just say that Charlie is twice as sensitive as you would?
Yeah, you can. So, right.
So, I mean,
so you're asking a question which has a fairly long answer, but maybe this will satisfy you. If you want to, maybe, I don't know. So if you want to identify what the actual representation of a particular population of cells is, then you really have to relate it to what all the other cells around it are doing as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Okay, so, you know, this means that you're going to have to draw on things like how do you tend to measure things in the world, so you can really, and all these things are essentially assigned by us as a part of the description, right? You could take the entire thing, I think this is what you're saying, and double it, right? And, you know, your description would be fine. But we choose them for real reasons. Usually things like it's a velocity because people measure velocities all the time, and so we're going to pretend that this part of the brain is representing velocity. And then the scale is determined the same sort of way.
All right. Okay, but you do have an external scale that's, that, have, that
yeah,
implicitly
so it's
or
science.
Explicitly related
yeah.
to scale.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Right, so now we want to decode this. And so to decode it, we're going to have to do something to our decoders. And in particular, we're going to have to weight them in some new kind of way. So in this particular instance, we're going to double them. Right. So now we have those double decoders. And at the top there, I've shown you've got... Your h of t is going to be just this shape of a postsynaptic current. They're occurring at every time tn because they get generated every time you have a spike arriving at Charlie. Right? And then they're weighted by some weight, which I've called phi to the f of x, where f of x in this case is just 2 times x, and the phi is the weight that you've determined. And the way we determine these weights is by doing a... we pick the optimal linear weight, optimal in the least square sense. Okay, so... Now we can sum these things up, so we're still doing linear decoding, and we see that we now get an estimate which is close to the function that we're trying to compute of the original input signal. Right. So what does this look like mathematically? So this is hopefully just going to give you a sense of all the parts. Here we've got GI. This is the nonlinearity that describes the cell. Right. So what happens when you inject a current into a cell? What kind of spike train does it generate? That's what GI is. X of t is the input stimulus. This phi tilde, that's the encoding vector I told you about before. So that tells you how the current going into this cell maps to the stimulus in the world. And out of that model comes a spike train, right? So we have a bunch of spikes from neuron I, and they are emitted at times tn. So this is our encoding. So that defines our encoding. And now to decode it, right? So this is what Alex and Bob are doing. So to decode it, that is trying to figure out what function is Charlie computing of that original input signal, we basically, this is a convolution between the postsynaptic currents and the delta functions, which were coming out. And this results in a placement here of all these postsynaptic currents. And then we weight them by this optimally determined weight and sum across both of them to give us our estimate at that of x. Okay, so now we've performed a computation of the original input signal. And hiding in here, these indices I are quite important because what they're really doing is they're accounting for that heterogeneity I talked about before. Right, those G sub I's could be all kinds of different things in one population of neurons, depending on what the data tells us. And similarly, each of the neurons has a weight, which depends on, you know, what that original encoding signal is like and what kind of sensitivity it has to stimuli in the environment. Okay, so let me just show you a quick example of this. So, of course, that was just a linear transformation. But suppose we have an input X, right, so this is just increasing over time. It's going into a population of neurons, right? So now we're supposing there's like 100 neurons in there. That projects to a population of neurons, another 100 neurons. And let's say we're trying to compute a function x squared. Now, what the work that I've done so far will allow us to do is to analytically determine what the connection matrix is here. How do we wire up all those A's to all these B's? And essentially, it's going to be just an interproduct between the encoders of neurons in this population and the decoders of that particular function, x squared, coming from the preceding population. So that now we have an analytical method for figuring out how to connect all these things up in order to compute the function that we defined at the high level, if you will. So we can take our pretend electrode and stick it in, and we can record a bunch of spikes. So these are spikes generated from a bunch of different neurons in B. We can say, well, if it's computing the function, it should be approximating this, which is the square of the input. And then we can actually decode the spikes coming out of B and say, yes, it does approximately does do that. And it's got a bunch of noise in it and stuff because neurons are noisy, and that's included in the model as well. So what's important here? Well, what's important is that we can do this for any feedforward nonlinearity. I've shown you simple examples, but you can do it for anything. And I think also important is that we've done it with no learning, right? So we can now string a whole bunch of these feedforward computations together, as many as we want, right? Because we know how to compute those connection weights between any two layers that we have happen to have. Okay, the third principle. So when we look at neural systems, it comes quite clear very fast that feedforward computation is not the order of the day. In fact, there is massive amounts of recurrent connections from very frontal areas to very areas at the very back. And even within single layers, neighboring neurons are often connected to one another. So there's a huge amount of reciprocal connectivity and feedback. So what we need to do is understand dynamics, because if you take a system of this kind and you take the connections and basically put them back onto themselves, you'll generally end up with a dynamical system, right? It's going to wander around somehow. So in order to describe dynamics in neural systems, we propose a new mapping of some standard representation of dynamics onto neural systems, right? So here is a standard representation of dynamics. Now what we want to do is understand, how does this representation relate to neurons? So the first thing we suppose is that the state variables are just going to be the neural representations, right? So the things that we defined before as neural representations, we're calling those state variables. The function, which is computed of x in order to determine the change in x, is of course something we can compute with our neural transformations. So these can be linear or nonlinear transformations. Now the thing that's missing from this is the dot, right? So we have to figure out, so basically an equation like this assumes that integration is the temporal transformation function. And in neurons, unfortunately, they're not integrators. If they were, it would have made our lives much simpler. So what we have to do instead is figure out, what are the dynamics that dominate neurons, and how do we map that to integration, essentially? So the approach that we take is control theory, but dynamical systems theory is exactly the same thing. And the canonical way of representing a linear system in control theory is like this. And basically, it just means this equation that I've written up at the top. So the change in x is equal to this recurrent matrix. It's just taking the value of the state variable and sending it back, and the input to the system that's driving the system. Now what we want to do is figure out, okay, if we change, yeah.
So x and u are vectors?
Yeah.
Okay, and the indices refer to different potentials in different neurons or different synapses?
Yes. Those vectors, so you might have 100 neurons representing a two-dimensional vector. And those indices, the index I is indexing the neurons that are representing that two-dimensional vector.
What do you mean by two-dimensional vector?
So suppose we want to do something like describe velocity, right? So we'll have neurons that are sensitive to velocity up and to the right or down and to the left. Okay, so that's just one-dimensional. But we might have 100 neurons, each of which have different sensitivities to velocities in those two directions. So the I is indexing individual cells. And the thing that they're representing is usually much lower dimensional, right? Okay. Because you want to represent it with some kind of precision.
Good. And then A and B are matrices.
A and B are matrices, right?
Okay.
So this is just a linear dynamical
and
system.
They're fixed matrices.
In this case, but they don't have to be. Yeah. So I mean, most. Yeah. I've sort of presented the simplest case in all these instances, and it works. It will scale up. So the thing that we're interested in doing here is figuring out, you know, how do we take the dynamics, which seem to dominate behavior in neural systems, which is also characterized by the postsynaptic current, and relate it to integration, which is a, sort of the canonical way of writing down dynamical systems equations, which I have indicated with my arrow. And we show in the book, basically, that if you take a model, a particular model for postsynaptic currents, which looks like this, it's basically a decaying exponential, which is an OK model, but not perfect, that the mapping turns out to be very simple. That is, if we define some dynamical system where we determine what A and B are, right? So we pick A and B such that they're giving us dynamics that we think is appropriate for describing the neural system. Then in the actual neurons, we would want matrix A prime and B prime defined by these equations, right? Where tau here is just the time constant of the decaying exponential. So what this allows us to do is to take all the things we know about control theory or dynamical systems theory, use those tools to write down our high-level functional description of the system, and then translate that into a system which has the kind of dynamics that is actually relevant for understanding neural systems. Because neural systems, neurons themselves, have their own dynamics, and it's not integration, right? So we have to account for that. Okay, so taken together, these three principles allow us to define something we call a generic neural subsystem. So this is supposed to be a definition of a population of neurons that could appear essentially anywhere in the brain, and you could string a whole bunch of these together if you want to describe multiple brain areas and multiple populations. So let me just begin by the sort of physical level description. Right? So this is the description familiar to neuroscientists. We have a bunch of spikes coming in. Right? So these are like the spikes that generated the currents that I showed on the second slide. These spikes generate postsynaptic currents in the population of cells. Those postsynaptic currents are weighted in some way. So these are the connection weights between all the cells. This processing, which occurs in the dendrites, results in currents, which go to the cell body. And in the cell body, there's some kind of nonlinearity, which responds to those postsynaptic currents that generate a bunch of spikes. Those are the output spikes. They can go to a subsequent population, or they can be recycled through some kind of recurrent connection. So this is sort of, you know, what we call the basic level description, and it describes the observed mechanism in a way. Now, what all the work of trying to state those three principles does for us is fill in these gray boxes. So the postsynaptic currents is straight ahead. We just have that model that I showed before, or some related model. And then the work on encoding, decoding, and dynamics lets us analytically compute the synaptic weights, which will have the kinds of dynamics that we want. So that's defined by these first two matrices. One's the recurrent matrix, and the other is the input matrix. We have a decoding, which is going to compute some function, or maybe not, right, depending on its representation or computation. And then we have an encoding, which now takes that sort of, if you were thinking of this as a signal at that point, and translates it into the current that's going to actually drive this particular population of cells. So having defined those three things, we have a method now for meshing them together, and it's linear. And it tells us how to connect all of the neurons in the preceding population, or this population, to neurons here in order to realize the computation and dynamics that we specified at the high level. So the core contributions of taking this sort of approach are two. I think the big one is analytic weights, right? So we can get away from learning, and we get away from hand-tuning weights. And the second is, in a sense, a corollary to this, and that is that those analytic weights are true also for dynamical mapping, or can be used, generated for some sort of dynamical mappings. So they're not just for feed-forward computations. Okay, so so I have two examples that I wanted to show, two applications, in order to show you that this approach is useful and gives us insights. And I might skip the second one, depending on the time. So the first is going to be navigation in the rodent, and the second is language in humans, language-based reasoning in humans. So if you take a rat and you stick them in a dark environment, so they have no cues, and you let them run around, they will run through a very convoluted path. But what is clear is that they actually remember where they are relative to where they started. And people refer to this as path integration, because if you integrate your path, then you know basically where you started, and you can directly go back to where you began. Right? And it seems like rats have a representation of this kind in their heads somewhere. So now we want to build a model of this. So what do we need? Well, the first thing we need to do is to get the hardware description. Right? So turn to a paper here, which describes data about a particular part of the brain called the subiculum, and it gives us information about tuning curves. So how do neurons in this part of the brain respond to where the rat happens to be in a particular environment? It gives us spike rate distributions and so on, right? Hardware description. We need to choose our neural model. So we chose some simple spiking neurons, and we have about 4,000 of them in this particular model. We need to give a description of the function that we think this part of the nervous system is performing. And so given the kinds of activities that you see in these tuning curves, it seems like in their heads, rats have cells which are devoted to encoding whether or not they're at various locations in an environment. So one cell will like if you're over here, and another cell will like if you're over there. And by like, I mean fire a lot if you're in those places, right? So the kind of a kind of representation that would encode where you are without any external information, right? So you have your own velocity information because you know how you're moving, but you don't have any cues from the outside world, would be to take cells like this and basically update a bump of activity. So the bump of activity is representing where the animal is, and update it with the velocity information. Right? So if the animal starts running around crazily, you'll always know that if you started here, right, you can get directly back to where you began, because your representation will implicitly encode where your starting position was. So this is going to be, and when I say stable bump of activity, basically it means that if there's no input, so if the animal's not moving, it has to, that set of activity has to stay there. That's only going to happen if you have some kind of recurrent connections. And then it moves around given the velocity information that's provided from other parts of the brain. And so, you know, given that description, right, as I promised before, now you put it through those three principles and you can get coupling weights from the neural engineering framework. So this is what it looks like when you run the model. So this is a biologically realistic model insofar as it's using a bunch of spikes. What I'm showing here is I've taken all the neurons and I've just ordered them by their actual spatial location. The darker the color, the redder the color, the more activity is coming from cells in this area. So this is a filtered version of the actual spikes. And you're looking sort of top down on this bump. The reason it's going in a circle is because we told the rat that it was running in a circle to make sure that it could run in every possible direction, right? So we know there's no asymmetries in the model. And so it can do the basic task. The interesting thing is that after one cycle, there's about 11% error in this model. The best previous model had about 100% error. So it would start here, and then it would be one diameter out after one resolution. Rats are not that bad at navigation. And then we're also using about 300,000 cells. So you are quickly going to run out of cells in the subiculum if you actually begin to use this kind of mechanism, especially for in the sort of limited way that this model is covered. So we think that by adopting the methods that we used, we can get an insight into a more plausible, that is more efficient in this case, neural mechanism, which accounts for the behavior better, since this one has much more error than you actually find in the rat. If you compare it to data, it explains all kinds of things. So for instance, if you take rats and put them... Yeah,
Did you have some sort of toroidal boundary conditions on
Yes.
That?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you put the rat on a fictional torus, let him run around, and don't.
Yeah, actually, if you put rats in real environments, they have toroidal representations. It's quite interesting.
The rats themselves do?
Yep. So you get cells that. So if the environment's big enough, depending on which cell you're in, it will fire here and there and there and there.
So it's not like they think that wall's.
No. Okay. No, but they basically, the sensitivity of the cell scales. Depending on the room. So some will only fire once across the room, but others will fire many times, and others will fire a whole room.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But that's actually not included in this model.
Right.
But nevertheless, that's why we can justify having toroidal representation. So if you put rats in different kinds of environments, the tuning curves will change, and so we can predict the ways in which those tuning curves change. The neurons are sensitive to both velocity and position, which is accounted for by the model. There's this thing called theta-dependent phase precession and amplitude, which people see and is shown up in the right-hand corner, but I'm not going to describe it in any more detail than that. One thing you notice is that if you turn the lights on when the rat's running around, if it's confused, which it will get after a while, it quickly updates its representation of where it is based on the stimulus that is provided. And it gets a very different kind of update if it's if it gets weak visual input compared to if it gets strong visual input. And both of these are accounted for by the model. I'm just showing strong input here. So suppose it thinks it's over there, and then it has cues which show, oh, in fact, I'm over here. Then you see this sort of compression of one of the bumps and jumping up of the other one. It's this very rapid change in its representation of its position. In addition, it provides some predictions. So it suggests that basically, as you change environments, you are not going to change velocity and direction sensitivity relationships in these cells. And last, every other model has always had some kind of dependence on head direction, so which way the animal's actually facing when it's running around the environment, and the accuracy with which it can do this path integration. And our model predicts that that is artificial. That is, in the real system, you shouldn't see that. Okay. So I have one more example that maybe I'll skip since I've been talking for 50 minutes. I have 10 minutes? Okay. I'll do it in. Okay. All right, well, I'll try to keep it quick. So what I showed you is sort of a typical model in theoretical neuroscience. That is, we've got a particular part of the brain, we've got a bunch of data about individual cells, and we've sort of well-characterized what rats do. But I think that these methods can extend to much more interesting, in my opinion, models. And these are ones that start to address cognitive behaviors. And so that's what this model is supposed to do. So here's a psychological task. Suppose I show you four cards, and I tell you on every card there is a letter on one side and a number on the other side. And your job is to tell me which of those do you have to turn over in order to determine if this rule is true of those cards. And I won't make this a test, but the right answer is A, which most people get. And then most people choose 2 if they choose anything else. But the next right answer is 3, right? Because if the 3 has a letter on the other side, the rule's been violated. So about 30% of people get this right. And that's the highest number I found. It's often lower than that, 10% or lower. Okay, so that's interesting. But what's even more interesting is if you take a logically isomorphic task, right? So this is exactly the same task, logically speaking. And I've got the what somebody's drinking on one side and the age of the person on the other side. And I present the cards to the people and I say, okay, here's a rule, which is, again, isomorphic to the rule I showed before. 90% of the people get it right, right? Everyone knows how to be a bouncer. That's what this is telling us. Okay, so why this switch, right? Or how are we going to explain this switch? So it seems to suggest that, I won't go into the psychological debate in much detail, but people had lots of theories about why this happened. So we suggested something very simple, which is essentially that you are doing context-dependent transformations of these rules that you're being presented with. So something about the content of the rule puts you in a frame of mind such that one transformation is relevant where it wouldn't be relevant in another circumstance. Okay, so how are we going to do that? Well, this is a sort of a quick sketch of the parts of the brain that we think are going to be relevant for performing this task, and most of this information comes from fMRI, right? So context information seems to be in the VMPFC. I don't assume you know where they are, but yeah, some part of the brain, right? The processing that we're explaining is in right inferior frontal cortex, so that's here. We think that you're going to have to take that context information and use it to determine what transformation is relevant in this context, so that's kind of an associative memory. Then you have to use the transformation, how do you reason about this rule, and apply it to the particular rule that's coming from the language areas, Wernicke's area. That's going to give you an answer. The answer is going to go to motor areas and make you turn stuff over. It's also going to be compared to the correct answer if you're given that information. And that's going to help you update your associative memory, right? Was this a good or a bad kind of reasoning to use in this particular circumstance? So, of course, there's a lot of work to say, well, how are we going to do this? We have to figure out what kinds of properties do the cells have? How are we going to represent vectors, high dimensions? How are we going to perform these computations and so on? But suppose all that's solved, then the model will do something like this. We turn learning on. So the first thing we're doing is telling it what contexts and reasoning is relevant. So we assume this happens during development at some point. So we say, okay, here's an abstract rule. And this is the way people tend to reason in this abstract case. So we're basically telling it the answer, right? Which is wrong. That is, you turn over the vowel and the even card. And then we're going to say, well, in the social case, right, where we have lots of evidence, and there's actually reasons to think that people might think that's the right, wrong answer. Anyways, I won't get into it. So in the social case, right, we tell them, well, here's how you reason in that case. And you get a different kind of answer, right? So this is the correct, logically correct answer. So now we turn learning off, and we say, OK, if you're given an abstract rule, how are you going to reason? And it picks the same answer that it was told to pick, and then social picks the same answer it was told to pick. OK, not really interesting, right? There was a lot of problems we had to solve to get to this point. What's actually the most interesting, I'm not going to show you, but you can take my word for it, that if you show it a different rule under the same context, right? So if we show it another social rule, which it's never seen before, it will perform the social kind of reasoning. And if you show it an abstract rule and say this is in the abstract context, it will perform this kind. And what people refer to this is as syntactic generalization, right? So the model is looking at the structure of the rule, not the content of the rule, to determine how to reason about it. And people have suggested that this is, in fact, the hallmark of cognition, right? So that's what distinguishes people from lots of other kinds of animals, is the ability to do this syntactic generalization. And so the model does it. Why is that important? Because what we wanted to show with this model is that we could build models at the level of individual cells and explain cognitive phenomena, give us some insight into them. And to the best of my knowledge, people haven't done this in the past. Oops. So that was just showing the kinds of spikes. Right. So what does all this look like? So this is filtered data out of the model, right? The model is actually producing something that looks like this. It's a big, complicated bunch of spike patterns, just like you find in the brain. So now we can compare this to what we see in the brain if we do it with fMRI and so on. We can make predictions about how learning is going to affect the behavior of this task and so on. Okay. Now what's relevant for that? For this talk in particular is the levels across which we have taken data and tried to integrate them in this model, right? So it's sort of an argument for generality. So the kinds of receptors that are in our model, right, had to be the kind that were most common in cortex through these fast type of receptors called AMPA. The neurons that we used, spiking neurons, right? So we had a biologically relevant model of individual cells. Maps and networks, right? We had to figure out how to connect them together to perform the computations of interest. And we have maps essentially of conceptual space instead of physical space. So in vision, you have a map. Like in the back of your head, you essentially have an isomorphic map to what's in the visual system or in the visual world. And we're supposing that a similar kind of map is there, but it's of conceptual space. So it maps the relationships between words, semantic relationships between words. And then lastly, at the level of the entire brain, we had to look to the fMRI to figure out, you know, what parts are going to be relevant, where are we going to get information about when we're wrong, where are we going to get context information, and so on. Okay, so hopefully these kinds of examples at least go some way to convincing you that we can take three simple principles and build models which are across a wide range of the kinds of information that we want to gain about the nervous system, and also incorporating a lot of the kinds of data that we have about nervous systems. But of course, there remain challenges. The main one is incorporating more nonlinearities. So we have some, but there are many that we don't satisfactorily account for. Things like dendritic responses, we assume they're linear, and in fact, they're not, right? They hit thresholds. Single cells don't always spike. Sometimes they burst. So how are we going to account for that? And on, reverse engineering some sort of nonlinear network, not an easy task. Another challenge is to characterize the relationship between this approach and learning. So we can include learning in our models, like I did in the last model, right? So we can just stick a learning rule in there. But the question is, right, we have this other method for constructing a network. If we think that network's really in the brain, how did the brain construct that network? It didn't have a neural engineer to come along and wire it up, right? So there's got to be some relationship between the networks that you actually find and the kinds of learning, the developmental history of the system. And we can't right now take that final network and tell you what learning rule would give you that network. It would be a wonderful thing to do, but we've tried really hard and have not had much success. And then lastly, another challenge remains is to figure out what the brain does. Right? So I haven't told you anything about what the brain does. What I've told you is how we think the brain does it. Okay, so this theory isn't one about what the function is that's computed by the brain. It's that if you think you know the function computed by the brain, this is what it would look like for a brain to compute that function. So it's a very useful tool to have in order to compare our models with all the kinds of data that we're getting from neuroscience. But it's not going to solve this very hard problem, which is, again, another one that we are trying to tackle along with everybody else. So where are we so far? Well, I think we're this person here trying desperately climbing up, you know, trying to get some footholds on understanding the brain. I want to know who the folks at the top are. Over lunch, maybe we decided those might be philosophers. but we're at the very beginning of a long climb, clearly, right? We're right at the beginning. And the idea of presenting these three principles is not to say that all the problems have been solved, but rather to say that maybe this kind of approach gives us the unification and the start on constructing a much better unified theory that we really need. So questions are welcome. Thanks.
Here for the rest of the afternoon, so if somebody would like to chat with Chris, let him know or let me know, and we'll schedule it. And Chris is also here for an early dinner, so again, let me know if you want to join. So, questions, comments?
Yeah. These networks you're constructing, how sensitive are they to little subtle changes? If you switch a connection or two randomly, do they still compute more or less the same thing, or does the function change dramatically?
Right, so we actually have a fourth corollary principle, which is that noise is a big part of understanding how neural systems work. And so we always try to do sensitivity analyses. Neurons don't transmit that much information, maybe 1 or 2 bits per spike. And so they're a fairly noisy system. And the answer is that with the right kind of hardware, so with the right amount of redundancy and so on, that you can build systems which are extremely robust to noise. A system similar to the one I showed, the rat path integration, we tested it by injecting independent Gaussian noise into all the connection weights, and we could get up to about 50% noise, and it would still perform functions. So they're highly robust, which is good, because neurons die off all the time, and people get hit in the head, and you want that kind of robustness. So the approach is not going to fall apart if you change something about a few cells.
So Francis Crickle was used to sort of counsel against hoping for unified theories of the universe sense. As the evolution sort of adapts, it makes do, it tinkers, it messes about, it uses approaches. I guess you'd sort of agree with that at some level, but I'm wondering how much of a limitation that is. Like, how far do you think you can get with the and where do you just have to look at special cases?
So, I mean, you can mean that in two ways, right? You can mean, is there going to be a unified theory of this kind, or is there going to be a unified theory of function? Right? So those are two kinds of theories. I think that maybe of this kind, we can get a lot farther. And that's because here we're, in a way, comparing kinds of descriptions of the system. And we're saying that, we have this language for describing dynamical information processing systems. What's the relationship between that language and the kinds of properties that we actually find in these cells? And it could well be the case that that mapping turns out to be fairly neat. in most cases, right? It might not, it could well not, but maybe it will. The question about whether we can have a unified theory of the function of the brain. So my research program is to try to see if there is such a thing. So we're trying to say, okay, you know, here's one principle which is going to explain motor systems, perceptual systems, like everything, right? But who knows, right? We're at a point right now where we just have no idea. It could well not work, but it could also work. If you start looking at, so my bet is on trying to understand how statistics is modeled by the brain, right? So we have these complex, we have a complex world, and if the brain has a consistent way of modeling statistical properties in the world, maybe that's going to be the unification. But it could also not be. I mean, I won't guarantee anything.
Yeah. It's a sort of empirical question, and you push it as far as you go.
That's right, yeah. But I think pushing these things as far as they go is also useful in their own right, because it really tells you, you know, if you understand where your unification falls down, right, that gives you a deeper understanding of the thing that you were trying to unify. But you know more about it than you did before.
Yeah, so you compared this problem of making a brain theory to programming, understanding a computer, right? And I think you compared your model to a compiler.
Yeah.
But there's also a question of the programming language. It seems to me by knowing the language, you would know also a lot, if not more, about what the brain is actually trying to do. In this particular case, it seemed like you modeled the brain as something whose whole whole purpose is to compute a function. So the language would be something that would describe functions. But I assume you're thinking of that as a first step, because I mean, there's many things that the brain does that can't, as far as I can see, be thought of in that way, like daydreaming, for example, or even making these kind of theories is not really in any clear sense. Like, it's not just some simple function from input.
I didn't say simple function.
It's any well-defined function. That's what I think, from some bunch of data to an output theory. So, maybe you're disagreeing. I was going to ask you, what more would you think that the brain does? But maybe you want to answer by saying nothing.
Yeah, research-wise, well, so I guess the first part of your question was asking about languages. What's the language of the brain? And so a lot of what I talked about, people talk about as being a way of trying to characterize the neural code. And in a way, this is what people mean by the language of the brain, right? How do these spikes mean things when they're sent around? And to me, that's like the machine language that you find in a chip.
The programming language, the high-level language that you...
The high-level language is going to be, dynamical systems theory, right? Some way that we're trying to characterize what this system is doing. And that is the thing that's then compiled into the language of the neurons, right, which is going to be, how do you connect these things such that when they send out spikes, they're communicating the kind of information they need to compute that high-level function that we specified in C, right, which is with dynamical equations. So I think I just wanted to say that to clarify the way I take the analogy to run. The question about, you know, does the brain only compute functions? I think that's a pretty good working hypothesis, because the space of functions is really, really quite big. And I never said simple function. I would never say simple function. Incredibly complicated functions are fine. There's nothing that I've done here. There's nothing I've run into. None of the examples you provided would make me think, for some reason, that they weren't the computation of a function.
So what was daydreaming, for example?
Daydreaming is moving through a whole bunch of states, right, in the state space of the brain. And any set of states that you're going to go through in the state space of the brain can be characterized in this way.
Maybe we have an misunderstanding. I'm not saying that there's not some dynamical law that characterizes the brain. I'm saying it's function that what the brain is trying to accomplish is not just taking some input and turning it into some output. But that's what...
Oh, you want... So you mean just at the periphery? Like, so just with...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, well, okay, so this then is a question of, do we think that we need to go to continuity in order to describe the system, right? So if we think that there's only a finite amount of information transmitted in the brain, right, then we can describe that with a Turing computable function, right? So, I mean, basically, the only way you're going to convince me that it's not a Turing computable function that's computed by the brain is if you can show that, basically, it's dependent on there being a continuum that the states of the system are defined over. And there's no reason to think that, because there's huge amounts of noise.
Well, maybe we should talk later.
Sure, yeah.
Steve,
yeah.
Can I ask you a
It might be a concrete example of what Raphael has in mind, but you know, your last file had associative memory in there. So it's not clear how remembering, how you characterize memory in functional terms. But I think you do. So even with your rat, when he's running around the maze, he has a kind of short-term memory because he has sort of his activation, you know, this constant sort of spiking of a particular neuron. He goes to sleep and wakes up, he might remember where he is. How is that modeled in here, and how do you think about that in sort of in information processing terms? Maybe it's
simple. I think there might be some strange communication trouble here, because so for me, a function is something that I can write down with an equation, right? And that and it has to be describable non-continuously in order to be Turing computable. Now, you know, if I've got something like a memory in there, that's fine, right? It's got some sort of inputs, the states of the system are changing over time. I can write down a function of time and of the state of the system, which describes how it changes over time. It's just a function, right? There's nothing, staying in one spot for a long time in state space doesn't somehow turn it into not a function. And I'm not sure, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question in a way, but you know, if I can write a function between any two layers of neurons, which is what I showed you, and I do that over and over and over again, then they're defining some bigger function, right?
Why don't we save the argument for afterwards? Except, Nick, you wanted to...
I just wanted to make a quick comment, which is that just because something... Well, it's a notion of computation. You can take simple functions and get very complex behavior out of them.
Sure.
And I think that may be where the disconnect is. So that you can, that the brain can be doing, that can be doing a sequence
each of
simple
the
things, and you can get extremely complex behavior. I mean, just look at sort of
algorithms,
or any kind of algorithm.
That's right.
And so, I mean, you can have simple functions being computed by the brain that do things like simulating in your model,
right.
That do things like daydreaming and remembering and sleeping, waking up, and all this stuff.
Yeah, chaotic states and all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
All shows up in the models.
Okay, well, there's clearly a discussion started. I have one last question. If you were a physicist and you wanted to know more about this field and getting into it, besides your book, which you've recommended, is there another reference or a...
So this, I can tell you the standard textbook in the field, and it, in fact, would be a stark contrast to the unification. So basically, in this textbook, they'll go through and tell you all the techniques that people use along the brain. It's called Theoretical Neuroscience by Abbott and Diane, Larry Abbott, who I guess was here before, and Peter Diane. And they're both trained as physicists, so hopefully it's written in a language that's not unfamiliar as well.
Okay, thank you. So thank you very much, and we look forward to your coming back since you just missed.
Thanks.